And welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by my returning co-hosts, Phil Brannan and Joe Kirk. Hello.
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 So we've got half of Joe Kirk because he left his brain in the bar last night, but he pulled through. He did well. We're proud.
I did well. I did better than what I've done previously. You know, there's that time where me, you, Jasmine were hungover and it was kind of just Phil, wasn't it, talking for an hour. So
that was a rough episode.
It sounds like you're making it out to be a regular occurrence. This.
It's more regular than it needs to be, especially on a blooming Friday. Honestly, if I pick any day to come into work hungover, Friday's not really the one, to be honest with you. But no.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say less has been learned, but I don't think it has been. So,
well, it was a good session, wasn't it? I mean, what we were talking about, I can't remember what we're talking about.
We were talking about the big and the small a bit. Yeah. So, small organisations to large organisations, the challenges they face, the difference in the challenges they face. Everything around that. It was really good, to be fair. We really got stuck into some topics of conversation, and time flew. It actually flew. I really enjoyed it. So I'm glad there will be a part two to this session. But what were your favourite parts?
Joe, what was your favourite part?
It's hard to pick a favourite part from such a good session. But I don't know. I think kind of just breaking down, you know, why should it matter? Why should data protection matter to small organisations? And kind of just saying, you know, talking through how it's great for reputation, you know, it builds trust with your employees and your customers, if you have customers, and your tenants or whoever, you know, the data subjects are, whose data you collect. And then kind of just giving a bit of an insight on, you know, our thoughts on how to kind of, you know, drive that through a business, I guess, was probably my favourite bit of the session, although that was probably the whole of the session, wasn't it, really?
Well, I think we probably spent 20 minutes talking about why it should matter. And again, that for me was a great discussion, wide ranging, a lot of input from the people, you know, participating. So I thought it was quite good. We covered quite a lot of ground as to, you know, why it should matter. And then, you know, is it a perception that it should matter? Is that, you know, distinctly different from the reality? You know, I thought it was a good thing to think about, to be honest.
Yeah, it was enjoyable. I liked as well talking about what organisations, you know, are going to be burnt most by this concept of data protection, the challenges faced, and the fact that, you know, small organisations with limited resource that are processing complex data or sending it internationally, you know, it's just a whole new level of stress,
but
really.
They've got the same burdens, you know, regulatory burdens as the international global companies, but you got probably fewer teams, smaller budgets, less competence, you know, but they've got the same challenges. And we were talking again on the session about the you know, what breaks does the GDPR give small companies or small organizations, and there's not that many, are there?
Yeah, the comparisons between data protection and health and safety, for example, as well. I think that was probably my favorite part, because we really broke down why health and safety is, you know, it's recognized across all industries and organizations, well, where it, you know, where it matters, and there are measures implemented, the law seems to be complied with, or at least, you know, it's organizations are aware of, they're not complying with it. But why is it data protection?
Yeah, without wanting to start the discussion again, you know, health and safety stuff. So, you know, we talked about food safety, particularly fire safety. We didn't really talk about video display regulations, the VDU regulations. Yeah, but there's also more of a culture of litigation and, you know, industrial action and, you know, repetitive strain injury type of. So there's a more established damages compensation framework, which we didn't actually mention on the sessions. We mentioned it now around health and safety compared to, you know, currently the courts are throwing out data protection claims, you know, for damages and distress. Whereas if you went to courts with a repetitive strain injury because your chair was at the wrong height, you'd be on a stronger footing. Anyway, we didn't mention that in the session, so that's an afterthought, which we should have talked about on the session.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll let you get into it. As I say, we'll be back for a part two where we'll probably explore more of the DPDI bill as well and the relation to small and large enterprises. So stay tuned for that one. But in the meantime, we hope you enjoy the session. and seen.
Nicely done, guys. Very nice. Do you know what it is? I think either next week or the week after is my 1 year anniversary of doing these podcasts.
Is it?
Yeah, it's in March sometime, yeah.
All right.
That's crazy that. I thought mine was in March. It's gone fast.
We probably both, I think you started before Joe, but.
Yeah, like a couple months before.
Or maybe we should, you should be in the seat then, Joe.
Yeah. Oh, he's.
I'm back. I'm here. Sorry, I missed all that.
Maybe you should be in the seat for it instead of Jazz.
I don't do a very good job. I give it all, you know, I give it all this, saying to Jazz, God, Jazz, how have you not nailed the intro? And then when it was just me and you, Phil, the other week, I was like, what, how the hell does she bloody introduce this thing? I mean, I can give it a go, though, but yeah.
It's up to you.
But honestly, I should give you more credit, really, Jasmine. You do a grand job.
Thanks. Anyway, let's leave it there.
On that note.
Yeah.
Have a great weekend, food. Everyone.
Yeah.
You
thank
too.
You very
you
much
too,
for your time.
Phil, Phil.
Yep. See you later.
See you later, guys.
Bye. And the challenges based
if there are
by
any. If there are any.
Potential
conclusions.
Challenges.
Oh, yeah,
faced by small and large organizations. So, you know, depending on what kind of organization you're in, you're going to have a completely different experience of data protection, most likely. There are, you know, different challenges faced depending on the size of the organization, the amount of data you're collecting, and there's a lot to explore there. So, yeah, we thought we'd have a chat about it.
A good one. Now, before we get into that level of detail, what anything you've noticed in the news, or have been doing anything exciting this week apart from writing articles?
You know what? I did get a couple of news pieces, but I didn't really have a chance to read them. I got a bit caught up in the articles. But
right,
I did
okay.
see about Capita. Capita and its shares have plummeted as companies have reported losses, you know, relating to that data breach they had last year.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've seen
that.
So. They've seen a drop in the share price by as much as 16% on Wednesday following the announcement of a pre-tax loss of $106.6 million for 2023 compared to a $51.4 million profit in 2022.
It's a big turnaround, isn't it? That? It's a big
turnaround. Yeah. So, bad year for them.
Yeah, we've seen lots of, talked about it, haven't we? They're talking about how much it costs them to recover from the cyber breach. And we've contrasted that before on these reports we've read from various other organisations that said, you know, the cost of data breach is, you know, a relatively small amount, like, you know, thousands, tens of thousands. Remember we had that discussion about maybe 6 months ago, we had a report from, I can't remember who it was, might have been IBM or the Poneman Institute or somebody, and they were saying the cost of data breach is, and we were saying, how? It's just, it cannot possibly be that small. Mm. Anyway, Capita has been posting big costs, haven't they? Have you seen anything in the news, Joe, or have you been?
No, I have. I have seen things in
you
the
have.
News. I saw an interesting piece, actually, about Elon Musk. He's decided to sue Sam Altman.
Yes, I saw that, yeah. Yeah.
The owner of OpenAI, which is the company behind ChatGPT. And the reason for that, essentially, Elon Musk said that they betrayed the foundational mission by putting the pursuit of profit ahead of the benefit of humanity. Mm. So, keep an eye out for that one. I'm not really sure what sort of implications that will have on ChatGPT. Potentially. Well, he's been posting some memes on X about it, saying that they're no longer called. What's the name of the open AI? Is it? And it's now closed AI. Very, very your humour, Phil. I don't know if ChatGPT is still working or if it is no longer in use currently. Or
I would have thought it would have a significant effect. Would you? I'm going to double check while we're talking.
Yeah, I don't know, but The Garante had some issues, didn't they, with them? Was that last month? I think it was, wasn't it? And they said that there's going to... was just saying it's unlawful, isn't it, I think, what they're doing. So I'm not really sure where that currently is. But I imagine these sort of things take a bit of time, don't they, to go through the courts and stuff. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Now, I noticed a few news stories about it. We've got loads in the news, actually, far too much. It is still there. I'm just loaded up ChatGPT now. There's a lot to talk about. We haven't got time today, have we? So we'll have to put some of this back into next week's GDPR radio session. Are you with us, Jasmine, or are you just untangling wires?
I don't know if you can hear me as well, because it's quite quiet coming through my laptop, so I thought I'd put these on.
You're putting your given all the interviews you've been doing today, put your studio headset on.
Yeah, exactly. Is this better? Exactly.
This is just the same.
Oh, fair enough. At least I know.
You look better. No, I've been reading about ChatGPT impersonators, which is revealing a security vulnerability. So there's some people that are hijacking the ChatGPT kind of login type of environments, and then hijacking it and diverting people off to other applications, which is a little bit worrying. Sort of fake apps impersonating real apps in order to trick users into downloading malware. That's been going on with the ChatGPT, and it probably just was a matter of time before it got abused in that way. I don't think it's probably the first time it's been abused in that way. It's come to light, but it's just interesting that a lot of people are relying on it, and now there's this kind of attack vector now just kind of appearing on it.
Mm.
So I also read about some polls that are highlighting the public's trust in AI is falling, which is, again, really, really interesting and worrying, because as it's getting more and more adopted and there's more negative news stories, the public's trust in it. And we talked about last week with vending machines, being used with biometrics and then AI. So it's, we need to do something about that if we're going to adopt it, the public losing their trust in it.
Mm.
And I read also that the gambling industry is embracing AI. So there's two angles to the way that they're adopting it. One is kind of to analyze the performance of horses in particular during horse races, and then using that to predict odds. But the other thing is they're tracking punters. They're tracking the punters. Now, they say that they could use it to identify addictive behavior, the development of addictive behavior, which would be a good thing. But they're also going to be using it for identifying, opportunities, commercial opportunities, which is not a good thing. And then finally on AI, I read about these people in America, it seems, who've been interviewed by Siri. So these people have attended job interviews and they've been talking to AI chatbots, virtually. So it sounded like Siri was interviewing me, and after halfway through every statement this person was giving, they'd say something along the lines of great, excellent, brilliant, right, now to the next question. And then halfway through the interview, this particular person said it just got curtailed right at the end, right, I've had enough, kind of thing, the end of the interview. So it was again really bizarre that it's being used in that way.
I remember reading, I think it was an example in relation to the EU AI Act, and that kind of use of AI will be banned under the Act, because I think it relates quite closely to using AI in a classroom to look at people's moods and, assess that and do with that what they will, really. So, yeah. It's a race, really, isn't it? What can we use it for until it gets banned? But
I lost my thread there because I've stapled my notes the back which way around. Flicked over to the rest of the next page. Like, oh, God, where's all my notes gone?
If you're having if you're having an interview with AI and it's through a computer and it's through a webcam, and they're getting your video back, I presume, can they not scan your face?
Probably depend on the software capability.
Privacy concerns around that, because obviously Apple have introduced Face ID, haven't they, over the last couple of years, and if they take a scan of your face, they can use that to breach other security measures and compromise all sorts of things.
I suppose it depends on what the AI is used for. Is it used to look at your demeanor and your professionalism in it, or just literally what you're saying, like a transcribing kind of model?
Well, what this is saying is that a person was asked questions like, what's your management style? Are you a good fit for this role? But then after a few minutes, it would say, great, sounds good, perfect, and then move on to the next question. After four questions, and said, right, the interview is complete, someone from the team will reach out later. They interviewed a recruiter who said that they only use it for like screening 1,000 applicants down to 10, and then a human gets involved. But even so, I think in your article, Jasmine, you've published, you're talking about bias and things like that, mm-hmm. you know, all that needs to be eradicated from these models before we start disadvantaging people from processing the data like that through AI.
It's a shame that as well, because you might get someone who might not have the experience or something, but they've got a real drive for the job and, you know, potential that won't get picked up on. So I can see how it will, you know, save on resource, but it's a bit of a shame, really. But David's got his hand up.
Yeah, I slightly disagree. One, I really doubt that this is technically AI that they're doing. So we employ some of this technology for sure in massive volume recruitment. And I actually slightly disagree with Jasmine's last point that people don't get the opportunity actually where we're doing candidate screening or potential candidate screening like that. Then what you have is the ability for them to present themselves rather than a piece of paper that might, you know, so they have the ability to come across better.
So would this be as opposed to sending an application? You just have this as the first stage or how would it work?
I think so. They essentially the positions that at least we're looking that where we've considered doing things like this. One, it's not in our territory at the moment, so it's not European. However, I don't see why we couldn't, because it's not truly AI either. But it's high volume recruiting. In our US market, whereby you go through an initial selection criteria to make sure that you would be acceptable for the role. Now, in Europe, that would probably be automated decision making. So you'd have to do things around that because you've got to meet a certain criteria. One, because you're a driver, a sales driver, so you've got to have a driving license. Yeah, it makes sense, but it's still automated decision making. It's that kind of piece. But after that, it's really just, I don't get where it's AI. It's really just a recorded interview. It's a potentially a bot that's asking you the questions, but it's not, definitely not the ones I've seen. And you know, we're doing this, it's not AI, it's not marking them, it's just a video that you can then watch back.
I think make a good point about allowing people the opportunity. So when you're recruiting, you know, it's like, you know, we're really busy and we get loads of CVs and loads of things from LinkedIn, and you literally probably look at it for a matter of seconds and decide whether it's in or out. Yeah. And whereas if you're getting a bit more information and a video presentation, the opportunity for somebody actually to present arguments back, admittedly, you know, maybe interviewed and assessed by AI algorithms, but at least they'll be consistent.
I think it's probably the difference between medium-sized businesses and larger businesses. When you're of the scale that we are, I would suggest that most people on here that are maybe our scale are using technology that either is already using or contemplating using some form of AI in candidate selection. Now, it'll be things like skills matching and inferring skills from CVs, from job titles, from things like that. And it'll infer skills, match that against the skills that it infers that you require from your job descriptions.
That's good.
And that will form part of the picture. You know, it's generally termed to be candidate ranking or candidate match. It's that kind of is the wording that they use around it. And the idea is it forms part of the picture. But, I mean, you think you're overawed. We will have roles that we literally get thousands of candidates for. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's that scale. And how do you, you know, manage that kind of volume of people?
So, that's a good. It's a good point you make, and thank you for raising. I think that, you know, technology is there to try and help us in our daily tasks, and you know, this is one where if we're not careful, we as privacy practitioners look at it with blinkers on maybe and don't see the other. We're just thinking of the potential hazards and risks rather than the necessarily opportunity as well, maybe.
Mm, yeah.
Easy. Another thing I saw in the news. I think probably this is the last one we've got time for, isn't it? Is I read about disgruntled cybersecurity workers are being found to be offering their services on the dark web for things like, you know, writing malicious code and orchestrating phishing attacks. Now, that's really, really worrying. I'll find the article and put it in the chat. Even actors, you know, there's this sort of, I'm a voice actor, reads one of these adverts. I can help with jobs that require making calls. I can act like a loan applicant to get loans secured. I can also act like an employee of a bank, phone company, etc. I conduct social engineering ops. Wow, that's worrying, isn't it?
Mm.
I'll just put
sorry,
that in there.
I thought Joe was going to say something then, but...
Yeah, it was round is it next?
I wanted to go back to the gambling point that you made as well. So I was having a conversation, and then we'll probably move on to the main part of the session, but I was having a conversation with my stepdad a few weeks back, and I don't know if anyone keeps up with cryptocurrency at all, but it's finally recovering from making some of the money I've lost back. But there's an AI, software or whatever, that you can sign up to. And, you know, you set up an account and it reads the market to place your money, kind of like a financial advisor, but an AI version. So it's very much, you know, on the ball, up to date, to basically know where to put your money in. And people at his work have been doing it, and they've seen the money triple in like a few days or a few weeks, and it's a bit mental, to be fair. I was tempted but since then he was mentioning last night actually that they've gone quiet, and there's been issues with them withdrawing the money, so they're not able to take the money out. So I'm assuming that, you know, it's some scam that they've lost out on. But
there's been one Bitcoin platform that has been offline a few times, hasn't it, over the last couple of weeks? Yeah.
All right.
I think demand for the service has just knocked it over. That's what I read a bit about. Right. I can't remember which particular coin or whatever it is, currency. Crypto platform, whatever. Now, the final thing, which we haven't got time for today, but I think we should drill into it next week, is that European Data Protection Board have issued a report about the effectiveness of data protection officers across all of the 27 member states. And they've issued nearly 62,000 questionnaires, and they got 17,500 back. So this is not an insignificant sample size, you know, of DPOs. Oh, yes, it's like a 700 million population, but not all of them are DPOs. But anyway, you know, the kind of things that are coming up, I'd be very interested to discuss and debate next week on the podcast. But I'll put a link in to that report, because there's a good summary in a Lexology or Mondac article. But then you can actually go and get the report and read it. And it's really, really quite interesting. And it's just interesting to think, you know, what type of things we come across in our work as consultants. Some people might think, oh, that resonates with me and what I've seen or what I experience as well. So I'll put that chat in, and hopefully we can have a really good kind of kick that around next week.
It'll probably have some relevance as well today, to be fair, in terms of the different challenges data protection responsible people face in small compared to large organisations. So it's a nice little segue.
It's almost like it was planned.
It never is. But so moving on to the main part of the session. So, in thinking about how to guide this conversation, me and Joe yesterday, we started off by thinking, we'll start with small enterprises and what does data protection actually mean to them. A lot of the time it's unknown territory, you know, it doesn't mean a whole lot, to be fair, but then we got onto the topic of why should it matter? So why should it matter?
Is that your question
I'm
to us?
I'm throwing it out there.
I think there's quite a few reasons of why it should matter to a small organization. I think the most like prominent one is that it instills confidence in customers, and it helps build you a good reputation. And I also think that if you start to embed a data protection culture early on in your business, then I think as you grow as a business, I think that will just flourish, and it will make it a hell of a lot easier to streamline your processes moving forward. And like, you know, and we sit on here and talk about Ropers a lot and how, you know, they're such a great tool to, you know, go in and find out what processing you're doing, you know, what data is going where, who's it's getting shared with, pull information off to, you know, put it into your privacy policy. And I'm in the middle of doing a Roper project for one of our customers, and they're a housing association. They're quite big, I think. I'm not actually sure how many houses they have, but they do things in the community as well. And there's quite a lot of processing, and only now have they, you know, decided, you know, we probably should get a Roper done. And it's just like trying to talk to so many different departments and, you know, getting all these things down. And it just makes me think that, you know, as if you did this when it, I know it's a bit hard, you know, if you're already big and the GDPR comes out, then you're still going to have to go through it, you know, that pain at some point. But as a small organization, having these things done early doors just makes, I think, makes your life a hell of a lot easier moving forward as a small business, hopefully growing to be big.
Yeah, well, it's a way to structure the data you collect from the offset as well, isn't it? It's organizing a proper effective processes from the offset, which isn't always people's first thought when setting up a new business. You know, they've got a lot of other things to think about, usually around whatever that organization is about, really, and they don't realize the importance of data protection and the vital role it can play.
So you set up a business, you know, if you're a limited company, you've got to go through, you know, the process of, you know, setting up a company with company's house. You got to register with HMRC. You know, this is law, you know, so you got to think about, if in certain industries, health and safety regulations. So why think about those aspects of legislation and not this aspect of legislation?
I think because this aspect of legislation isn't just a tick box kind of situation, you know, it's very much
health and safety.
Well, I'm not an expert in health and safety, to be honest, but with data protection, I think a lot of the time even solicitors don't realize the fact that, you know, it's a gray area, because it's very much dependent on the context. It's massively dependent on the context. It's not a one size fits all kind of
Let's say you wanted to open a food business, or even just a little van selling cups of coffee at the train station. You know, you need to consider food safety law. You need to consider fire safety law. You need to consider, you know, other law. So why, you know, okay, you might not be collecting data in those scenarios, but why is data protection law perceived to be on a lower tier of law?
I think it comes from priorities, I think, is where it probably comes. I mean, as a business, you see, okay, what do we need to do, the things that we need to have in place from a legal perspective. You know, you mentioned around HMRC, that's probably going to be the first thing that you're going to get boxed off, because, you know, you see it in the news all the time, don't you, about, you know, tax evasion and stories of such. So I think maybe, yeah, as a small business, you start thinking, you know, how often do you see small businesses get fined? There's not real much appetite for that unless it's PECA. So I guess from a data protection perspective, you're probably going to sit there and think, you know, there's not really too much we do. We'll just scrape together a privacy policy, stick it on our website, and jobs are good. And when actually that's not the case, is it? But, you know,
but is it about awareness? Is the ICO not really fulfilling their obligations of making people aware? You know, set, you're going into business, you're posting posts later, these are the things you need to do. Yeah, I just don't understand why you know, some laws are, you know, where it negatively impacts people, like food safety, like fire safety, you know, why data protection, which can ruin people's lives if it's done badly, why it's regarded as less important.
Do you think it's down to insurance purposes? You know, it's quite clear if you've got any issues around fire safety, if you have a fire, then you need to be covered by those things. And probably then, if you take a step behind, that comes down to the awareness that you're talking about, Phil, because there are fines available, and, you know, individuals can complain, but even awareness on that level isn't as widespread. I don't know if that's because obviously there's been data protection law around for decades, or centuries if you want to go so far back.
I don't go that far back personally. I might look like I do, but I don't, honestly.
I was going to make a joke, but I thought, you know what, I'll let you off today. You did it to yourself. But yeah, I mean...
Petra's point is good. I mean, why we like working in data protection is because it's vague, it's woolly, you can work with it. If you know what you're doing, you can bend any scenario to suit what you want to try and achieve, pretty much, can't you? You know, take a risk-based approach, do what's appropriate and proportionate and necessary, all of that type of stuff. But to everybody else, that is an absolute turn-off. I just want to know, can I do this? Wow, well, it depends. You know, that's always the situation. If it was, maybe if it was a bit clearer, or there were more clearer guidelines, or there were more clearer advice around, maybe it would make it easier to do properly, and therefore people might actually embrace it more. You know, I think it's a great point that Petra makes.
That's part of the reason why I put together another article a couple of weeks ago about, you know, the like an overview of your data protection compliance, the main steps, because
I thought that was great. That was, I thought that was a really good bit of work.
A lot of organizations just they don't know, and I can't blame them for not knowing, because you have to navigate the whole piece of, you know, legislation to understand and pick out the bits that you need to be focusing on. Like, obviously there's some areas that just apply to everything you do, and then there's some things that you need to do you know, that are more specific, like a DPIA. So you've got your principles that apply to everything, and then you need to do DPIAs and put in place contractual terms and, you know, all of these different things. And it's like, you just need a step by step. Okay, this is everything that I need to consider. Have I got these things? Yes, no. Are they regularly reviewed? Yes, no, etc. But that's not as easy to come by in data protection, unless, you know, you get data protection support by a consultancy company, or you've got people who've been in it for years. It's a tricky one to navigate in that sense, I'd say.
Yeah, and Jean said that, you know, people know they won't get fined, but how do they won't get fined? You know, you do read the press about people getting fined for data protection non-compliances, and, you know, you read about breaches and this and that. It's almost like there's this network of discussion, like, you know, these are the exceptions, but if you keep your head down, you should be okay. But I know that kind of thing doesn't happen, but, you know, there is a perception that if you keep your head down and fly under the radar, you're going to be okay.
I think in the same way that with other legislation, you know, you can put things in place and then it's done. Say, for example, health and safety, if you've got your measures in place and they're done, you know, they're pretty set, unless you decide to, I don't know, in a restaurant, I don't know, like,
you should
introduce
review
something
them,
though,
new. You should review them, though, shouldn't you?
I just think it's more, like we're saying here, it's more clear cut. Whereas with data protection, I think, you know, public facing documents as a privacy policy, maybe cookies, if you've got that awareness to pick up on that as well. And then organization, a lot of people will think, okay, we need a privacy policy and a data protection policy, and that's done. And it's not the case. And I think that's the level that I come across quite a lot, where people are like, oh yeah, we're pretty good, we've got this and we've got that. And it's like, I feel sorry for you to break the news, you know what I mean? There's a lot more to come.
I think Hayley's point is good as well. So we've been mentioning on the podcast, we've been doing work in other jurisdictions. I've been doing a lot of work in Jamaica, and there are custodial sentences of up to 10 years written into the data protection law as you know, for transgressions and offences. But there isn't anything explicit in the Data Protection Act or the GDPR. You know, in order to get people in prison, the ICO has got to pursue them under the Computer Misuse Act, and they have successfully put people away, but only for, I think, 6 months was the maximum sentence. But in the Data Protection Act, there are penalties on, I think it's section 199, penalties for directors of businesses, but it doesn't specify what those penalties are. I think it uses the term, you know, the directors, officers, and other such people, like partners and organizations, will be punished. There'll be punishments, but it doesn't specify what those punishments are. So again, you'd think that, you know, you're setting up a business, or you're a director of a business, or you're on the board, you know, as a non-exec, you'd think that you would be aware that you carried those kind of liabilities set out in the Data Protection Act. But again, I don't think people do. And the ICO has done nothing about prosecuting directors, as far as I'm aware, or officers of companies or organizations under Section 199 of the Data Protection Act. I'm sure it's Section 199. It might be 198, but it's definitely in there at the back of the Data Protection Act. It's one of the last, might be 192. It's one of the last few, kind of, in the last dozen or so sections. But so we talked about why it should matter. But I mean, one of the things is, you know, how is the GDPR different for small businesses? Because there's not a lot in there that gives them a break. You know, the only thing I can think of is that small organizations employing under 250 people might be exempt from ROPAs if they've got simplified operations. But the way I read the GDPR, you still have to supply the same information to the ICO on request, if requested. So you've still got to compile the ROPAs. If not explicitly, then implicitly, the ICO comes in and asks you a load of information that you have to supply according to Article 30, brackets 5. So it doesn't really give people many breaks, does it? So you've got the same obligations and onerous obligations, in some instances, applying to, you know, small companies or organizations as well as big organizations.
Yeah, I don't think the differences are necessarily in the law itself. It's probably more around, you know, the processing that you do and the extra burden that probably brings on you as an organization. I think, you know, the bigger the organization you are, the chances are that you have more complex processes. You know, you have data probably going, you know, to various territories around the world. You might even be part of a group that has subsidiaries, which, you know, that brings its own complications, as you found out, Phil, when working with Vicky, with one of our customers. So I don't think the difference between the two is necessarily in, you know, what the law instructs you to do, so it says you can and can't do. It's probably more around the processes that you do and the complications that brings, I think, to you as an organization.
I'm just to pause that, because I've just had a thought, right? So I mentioned about food safety, but if you're doing any kind of food oriented qualification, you know, like in my day, I can't remember what it was now, but there was a City and Guilds HND, I think. If you want to be a chef, you have to go through a process, yeah? And within that, there is education about food safety. But there's nothing really in there, similar type of thing, for data protection. I've done business degrees and business courses, and data protection has never featured. In fact, we recruit law graduates like your good self, Jasmine. Was data protection part of your law degree? No. Never part of a law degree unless you do a specific, you know, postgraduate course. Mm. So it's no wonder that people are coming out of these kind of educational institutions, I would say, blissfully unaware of the data protection law. And if it was up to me, I'd bake it into everything, you know, in business law, company law, yeah, health and safety law, you know, maybe topical law. I did a food science degree, so we did food law, you know, but data protection law should be in there. I don't disagree.
With, say, for example, with food and health and safety, they're both physical things, and we're still, you know, technology has advanced exponentially in recent years, but it's still something virtual. It's still something that's, you know, handled by an organization that's the individual might not directly see or understand or question, unless, you know, they think they've not consented to something and then they complain, and that can happen. You know, people do complain, people make rights requests all the time, but I don't think that it to the same scale as if someone was to get a worm in the food. You know, there will be
a snail in their lemonade bottle is, yeah, a classic case.
Exactly. I forgot what that case is called now, but
something on the carbolic
Stevenson something.
That's right, yeah.
Mrs. Stevenson, something like that. But yeah, so maybe that's a big factor as well, in, you know, in the difference between data protection. People are still catching up with it, you know, they're still understanding, they're still moving away from paper copies and that kind of thing. And I know that falls part of data protection, but it's that transitional period where awareness is spreading. It's just, you know, it takes time, and we need the ICO to do a bit more.
Yeah, I think another thing that has like a factor in terms of, you know, like you've mentioned, Phil, you're comparing the GDPR or data protection law to, you know, food safety. I think the repercussions that come from the individuals themselves for data protection, not many people know about data protection. Not many people know they have the rights, they can exercise it. So organizations don't really get that many complaints. But if you go into a restaurant and you find your food is, you know, it's got worms in it, it's going to get sent back, you know, and it's quite a common thing.
That's a good example, Joe.
Do you know what I mean?
I think I've got an idea. I said Gordon Ramsay goes in, like, you know, horror kitchens. We ought to do a TV program of horror governance departments or horror data processing. We go into so
back to the big and small of it. So we're on the small of it.
Who has the, what's the worst case scenario? Who do you think has got the toughest of times?
I think a small organisation that doesn't have the resource, you know, to really grab data protection by the handles, that is processing really sensitive information, probably.
Maybe exporting products, you know, or maybe they're a charity as well. So
yeah,
you know, there's some scenarios where you've got, you know, small organisation with multi-jurisdictional influences, high risk processing, they've therefore, you know, got to appoint a DPO, got to do DPAs and a lot of stuff, you know, got to keep ropers, got to consider the European and other legislations. I mean, that is a lot of stuff. You know, maybe the organisations that seem to trigger a lot of subject access requests, you know, they're quite, you know, could be quite voluminous, could be quite difficult to process. There's no breaks in the legislation or the guidance for organisations in that situation. They've got exactly the same to contend with as the multinational corporations. You might have, you know, teams all over the world dealing with it.
Yeah, when
it's
I was
not about
thinking
scale,
about
is it? It's about complexity.
Yeah, when I was thinking about this earlier, so you know, one big difference between small and large organizations is resources. So I was thinking of that in the context of human resource. So a lot of small organizations, you know, they'll wear every hat under the sun, whether that's HR, finance, data protection, etc. So that's a challenge in and of itself. And then also in terms of money as well, so financial resources, whether that's training. I also thought as well about technical resources. So, you know, you can't really afford as a small organization if you're not making that much money, the use of one trust, for example, or, you know, a data management system as opposed to a large organization. And I suppose that just even broadens the disparity even more.
Yeah. But in terms of that, also on resources, expertise, you know, so the job of compiling a ROPA and maintaining a ROPA is not a mean undertaking, is it? It's quite a significant piece of work doing it properly, doing a data mapping. Now, if you don't have the expertise to do that, or it's going to be a much harder job to actually get through it.
It takes and time as well, doesn't it? You know, because you have to go and do research about that. If you're an organization, you have to. Yeah, you know, you think, okay, right, we need to get a ROPA in place, and you can't afford to appoint a DPO, so you take the responsibility yourself. You have to find time in the day, don't you, to go and carry out research.
Yeah. But it's not a switch job. It takes a week to compile all the information. Yeah, so it's not you've got to be quite dogmatic about it and have a program of work that has got, you know, some longevity to it until it's finished. And then once you've got it in place, that's not the end of the story, is it? It needs maintaining.
Yeah.
I find as well a lack of appetite for data protection for smaller organisations, more startups.
Yeah, going to come to that kind of, I get, you know, understand the startup thing, but I mean, the kind of the whole leadership and the focus bit is also important. So the startup bit, you know, you start up a business, your priority is to get work and then deliver high quality work. You know, I get that, right? Because we've been there ourselves in this business and being there in other businesses as well. You know, your priority is to try and keep your compliance burden and your time spent on that type of stuff to an absolute minimum, so you do only focus on the essentials. But I would say that this is one of the essentials. But you know, back to points made earlier, it's not as easy as do this. It's like, you know, do whatever you need to do that addresses the risks.
Steph's asked in the chat, any views on language relating to data protection? Just a personal bugbear of mine, but people who go to a restaurant and hoping to not get food poisoning are not food hygiene activists. Staying in a hotel and expecting fire alarms, working fire escapes, are not fire safety activists.
That's a very good point, actually. Yeah, I mean, the language is also quite tricky and confusing. I get wound up by people that insist on using the term personally identifiable information around, you know, European and UK processing activities, because, well, it winds me up anyway. But you're right though, you know, if you're pressing for your privacy rights, you're deemed to be an activist, but if you're pressing for your food hygiene rights, you're not, you know, I would have thought, or your disability rights, something else.
Yeah, it's almost like it's got to be, you know, there's got to be knowledge of the individual as well as the organization for ensuring this, because they've got to understand their rights, they've got to understand what processing is, the lawful basis that are available to them, and so on. So, but maybe that's what makes it more difficult.
I do think it comes back though to people knowing about it. So the point that Steph's made in terms of, you know, you're not a food hygienist, it's because everyone expects your food to be clean and, you know, served in a, you know, in a presentable way, and the same with working fire alarms. You just expect that to be, you know, in place, but you don't expect organizations necessarily to protect your data, probably because you're not aware of actually what's happening with your data. You know, how many times do you go on a website and just press accept all on cookie banners because, you know, you can't be bothered to go in and change the preferences?
Well, yeah, it's knowing the implications having measures in place and, you know, accepting all or not accepting all. And, you know, all of a sudden out of the blue receiving unwanted marketing emails from organizations that you never signed up to and things like that. That's, I suppose that's more the customer facing side of it, which is probably why there's more fines around PECA and direct marketing than the GDPR in general.
Well, it's easier. The food hygiene bit that's probably most applicable here is like food labeling regulations and the people's awareness of allergens and requirement to declare them. So I was in London yesterday. I went to had a sandwich that was freshly made right in front of my eyes, but it came with a massive label stuck on the back of it with all the ingredients in, which was I thought was odd really, because I don't think I've ever had a sandwich from a sandwich shop that has come with a label with all the food on it. But you know, that kind of food labeling, it's all right for, you know, Nabisco and Nestle to kind of apply food labeling regulations, you know, because they're a massive organisation. But if you've got like a corner shop sandwich shop, if actually it was a sandwich booth at the XL. If they're also hiring to, you know, ensure they've got all the food, it's a much bigger burden proportionally for the size of the organisation. But those to me are the, it's not about worms in your food or food that's been in the fridge too long and that type of stuff. This is kind of the niche areas of it maybe to focus on. I think there's things that the GDPR doesn't do that I think it should do that would make things a downside easier for us. So if you had to submit an annual return or something, you know, in the Jamaican Data Protection Act, you have to submit an annual return by the 31st of March every year, you know, which they call the Data Protection Impact Assessment. But it's basically an annual return to say what you're doing. If audits were mandatory, you know, in certain circumstances, that would also mean it got on the radar. In the Jamaican Data Protection Act, you have to report non-conformances as well as breaches. Now, if you were reporting non-conformances, the ICO would get absolutely inundated, wouldn't they? But again, that would be something that would give it a bit more teeth, as would the custodial sentences that have been being mentioned.
Yeah, I really want to see that happen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we're dumbing it down, aren't we? Far from beefing up or focusing on making it easier for certain sectors. We're just trying to pull the rug under everyone's feet.
We'll talk about the DPDI bill more on part two as well, because this is a part one and two session. I mean, we've only got 15 minutes left, and I feel like we've barely covered what we want to cover today. But Phil, do you want to read it out loud?
What?
What you're reading in the chat?
Oh, my reading skills are important. We've normalised language to confuse. Most consumers appear to have no understanding of terms commonly used by the industry in privacy notices, including pseudonymous, and again, great point, pseudonymized information, a hashed email address, advertising. This is all kind of types of information that are widely used to track and influence consumers, unbeknown to them. Again, I think it's a really good point that building on what Steph said, unless this is Steph saying a bit more, yeah, it is. You know, it is confusing language, and it isn't something that some privacy practitioners understand, as let alone, you know, consumers.
Even terms like processing and personal data, to some degree, people don't understand what that actually entails or the scale of what it entails.
Understand what personal data is. It's just really complicated stuff.
I'm gonna drop myself in it here and say that when I've been on some Roper calls recently, I've struggled a little bit when I've been having calls with people, and they've been struggling a little bit in terms of the terminology and like what processing means and like, you know, trying to explain lawful basis and stuff. And it's something that I've probably not really reflected on myself in terms of being able to water down what processing is, what a processor is, and what a controller is. You know, it's something that I probably have to work on myself. I think me and Jasmine have had a bit of a discussion, and I think I'm getting better at it. But it's not easy, is it, trying to
water these things down? No. Well, or pin them down. I was on a call with a customer maybe Wednesday who's got this fairly complicated contractual situation, and they are acting, it would appear, as both a processor and a controller for certain aspects of this relationship they're in. So it isn't as simple as saying this is a processor and that is a controller. It's like, you know, you are actually potentially a controller in common, a joint controller, an independent controller, and a data processor for a big processing project you're involved with. Now that isn't easy. It's not easy for me to get my head around, or anybody possibly on the call, but you know, if you're in this case, it was an organisation appointed by both the NHS and the local authority. No, appointed by the local authority to process mental health data. But they've got a network of contractors that are actually doing the work. These are independent freelance contractors, and the data is collected on the systems belonging to the person who made the call, not the local authority, but the person who made the call, which actually was the housing association. But then the data has got to be sent off to the NHS for their mental health performance statistics. So it's quite a complicated arrangement. But you know, because they're providing the system for the contractors to use to fill in the data, it's likely they're acting as a processor for that. But they're also acting as a controller in common, because they're using a pot of data for different purposes. And they're probably a joint controller with local authority. And then they're disclosing data to a third party, the NHS. I mean, it is not a straightforward arrangement.
I'm just putting a link in the chat to an article, the article that I was talking about a couple of weeks ago, which is the main areas of compliance that you need to consider as an organisation. And this is not by any means an exhaustive list. It's just something, you know, the main points that you need to be aware of that might help people who are part of smaller organisations listening in, just to know where to focus your efforts. So hopefully that can be helpful anyway.
Another area that I think is quite tricky for smaller organisations is security and IT. So in many small businesses, including our own, you know, we contract out large chunks of our IT security. We don't for some systems, like our Salesforce system, that's all done in-house. But for others, like our Microsoft platform, you know, we contract that out to a third party. So we've, I think, possibly got less control and awareness over, you know, what measures are being implemented. You know, and therefore harder to demonstrate we're taking a proper risk-based approach. You know, maybe that's mitigated by having a fairly high standard across everything. You know, but for small organizations that are using these 30 platforms and outsource services, I think they've probably got a tougher time than a bigger organization with an in-house IT expertise.
Potentially, yeah. I think a lot of the time, a smaller organisation might say, oh, it's fine, we've got that in hand, this organisation specialises in it, so it's all good. And that's a risk in itself as well. In preparing for this session, me and Joe were thinking about some of the warnings that we would send out to small organisations, and one of them is just don't assume that, you know, something's compliant because you've taken it from another organisation. So that can apply in this situation, or in, you know, the example of taking a privacy policy from someone else's website and thinking, oh, they've got, this looks good enough, without knowing, you know, what is actually included in it, because a lot of the time they're not compliant just because, you know, it might be another privacy policy from another organisation in your industry. It's not necessarily right. So be careful.
I think same it goes with further than that, though, as well, doesn't it? Because you do have to be careful in terms of carrying out research and data protection. And you know, we've been critical, haven't we, on here before about the ICO and some of the work they put out, you know, just going back a few months ago when we had a look over their privacy policy template on their website. It was missing a handful of fields, wasn't it? So absolutely, Jasmine, you are right in terms of, you know, just maybe try and find it from a couple of sources. And if you do ever take anything from the ICO, and probably this is more for the chatbot, make sure you download the transcription of the chat, just so, you know, you can prove that, well, this is what you said. So, you know.
Yeah, I've had to do that a couple of times, actually. I had it once where I can't fully remember the ins and outs of it, but one of my customers called me, and they had a situation where I think the individual had asked them to delete certain information, but they didn't want to do that. I can't remember fully. They had like a privacy notice that didn't cover the process and they were doing for this individual. And they'd already promised that they would delete her information, but it was a risk to delete it because she was, you know, flagged as someone to look out for and look after, kind of thing. Much suffered with mental health at this tenant. And it was one of those, it's like, can you keep processing without letting them know that you're processing this certain information? There's no exemptions that apply. It feels morally wrong if it causes a risk to let her know, if it causes a stress to let her know that you're still processing her information. But because she's very vulnerable. But then at the same time, you'll be breaching GDPR if you don't tell her that. So then I had this forward and backwards with the ICO, and it got to a stage at the end where they were like, well, go off your what you think is morally right, but, you know, accept the risk. So I was like, download.
Yeah, Phil, you said that, didn't you, the other week, that if something doesn't feel right, don't do it. And I think in this case, you know, you have to take, you have to put the person first, and either way, you're going to get cut out. So I think the best thing to do is probably carry on doing what you're doing to protect them, to monitor them, and don't tell them so that it doesn't cause any further stress. I think that's probably the best way to go with that. Yeah. And if the, you know, if the law stops you from doing something, then, you know, just
if it feels right, I usually I think for me, a good rule of thumb is if it feels right, then there's probably a legal route to do it. If it feels wrong, then there might not be.
We had this conversation this week, didn't we, Phil? And I asked you a question about a case that I was dealing with, and you was like, well, what does the customer want to do? And then we can find how the GDPR will enable that route. And that's what goes back to what I was saying at the beginning of the session, as the GDPR isn't a blocker, it's an enabler. It gives you the way to use people's information whilst also doing it to protect the privacy. You know, it's a win-win.
It's the most classic one is, you know, we've had a request from a third party for personal data. But the obvious question back to the controller is, well, what do you want to do about it? Do you want to fulfill the request or not? Because if you do, then we could probably find a legal route to do it. And if you don't, then we probably could easily blame GDPR and say we're not doing it.
Yeah. Oh, let's not turn more people away from the GDPR, though, please. So we've spoken a lot about the problems, especially faced by...
As business people, I was going to say, as business people, you know, we need to understand we have these choices. You know, it's not about GDPR says no. It's GDPR says, no, do what's right, do what's appropriate, do what works. You know, and if people understood it more, they might come to more of those conclusions rather than thinking, as our politicians seem to think, that everything in the world that's bad is because of GDPR.
Mm. Yeah. So we've spoken a lot about the issues faced particularly by small organisations. How do you, you know, how do you challenge these? How do you fix these problems? How do you address them? So around resource and knowledge and awareness, where do you start as someone in this situation?
Resources driven by budget.
Yeah, good point.
So how do you get around it?
My point.
Turn to the dark side, like a lot of cyber professionals are. No, don't.
What are your thoughts, Joe?
Well, I was going to say, similar to the GDPR, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all thing for it. And I mean, if you go back to our episode, I think it's 142, when we had that session, didn't we, the roadmap for a DPO in terms of like the top 10 things, and all three of us had very, very different opinions, didn't we, on where do you start in terms of data protection compliance. And I don't think there's necessarily a one-fit-all model. I think it's, for me, in my opinion, quick wins, what can you get off the bat and done nice and early as a new organisation? Obviously, you know, register with the ICO, probably get some policies written and get them published. I couldn't find my PowerPoint to actually just rejig what our lists were, but I think mine were kind of around policies, procedures, maybe then start to build your ROPA and go out that way. So I didn't really answer your question there, did I?
I think there's a lot to be said, and I've been an advocate of this for many years, of kind of building your own peer-to-peer network. You know, we provide this and do this podcast to try and, you know, get this community of data protection officers in the UK that are interested in listening about this and chatting about it. You know, they can work together. Us as consultants, I shouldn't say that, should I? But they don't need us as consultants to tell them, you know, how to do things or to show them things or to share templates or to develop things. There's 69 people currently on this session, all of whom are possibly in the same boat or a similar boat, who've got, you know, experiences, they've got skills, they've got knowledge, you know, and this is not rocket science. It's fairly formulaic, you know, the data protection law stuff. And so, you know, if you are under-resourced without a budget, you know, you've got to reach out to people around you where you can get free support.
Yeah.
Which isn't necessarily the ICO.
That's the thing. I mean, everyone listening into this, you know, you've got some sort of guidance of where to start, whether you want to talk to us or just listen to the podcast and understand from them. It's another thing, you know, those that haven't found this, that aren't in the situation where they're even considering data protection, to know to look out for it, which is a concern, but not really one that we can address, to be honest. But Sean said in the chat, one way to get a company to recognize data protection is to submit an expense claim for about 20 million. That soon turns heads, to be fair.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I've been tempted to report some organizations to the ICO for the cookie compliance at times. But I've never done it. So if you ever receive a complaint, it's not from me. Michael's got his hand up.
Well, I think you're muted, Michael.
Yeah.
Probably good. I kind of swore there for a minute. Anyway, I was going to say, like, one of the things I had found out was, I'm not having a good day, Phil. Just trying to involve everybody in one of those major breaches or instances or anything where you're reporting it in and making sure they actually become aware and start doing the work for it, or else you end up being the person who just shadows everything, tries to manage it on your own and becomes overwhelming, especially with the 72-hour deadline, so that everybody sort of becomes aware about what it is, because you can keep giving them training, throwing slides at them, talking to them about it again and again, but a lot of people will just fall back into their old ways and they will see us as a blocker, and they don't realize that actually then they become accountable for what they've been promising to do. And then it also for the higher chain, the higher up the level of the chain as well, because you get them to organize it and move anything, and then you kind of can be there a little bit more impartially to guide them the right way. Or else, you know, every organization I've worked in, they tend to be completely absolutely underfunded. There's no money for training, courses, systems. You're basically asking people in other departments to pay for things that will be helpful for you and trying to get them on the same journey. And you can't just keep on using the fear tactic, like the 1 million or the fine or thing like that, because they will switch off because it's not a good motivator after a while and it's been used for a long time. And a lot of them don't understand what you do as well. Like, I usually get people saying, you're in data governance, you can fix this PCI case, there's something else. And they just don't. But then as you start stepping back and encouraging them, they start talking in meetings about it and providing better influence. So that's the only way I can do it. And obviously mention and record how much time you're doing in the organization, doing additional admin work and everything else, to see if they become aware about what we do, so they don't just think we just like walk around and just chat to people, or make, you know, only work on incidences or breaches that come in, but we're actually try to be less reactive.
Are you full-time DPO, Michael? Have you got other duties, or are you just dedicated to this?
I'm not a DPO, so we hire a consultant to be one. So I'm usually the person doing all the practical work and the admin work. And usually I've got a lot of people asking me questions and doing things as I can, and then trying to be ahead of something. So,
Yeah, the point you've raised there, it's one that gets more difficult the larger the organisation, isn't it? And it's that culture, trying to involve everyone within the organisation, around data protection is the goal, really, to improve the culture. But it's an uphill battle at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah, there's some fantastic people. I've got colleagues and mentors, and you guys are fantastic, because sometimes you bring up some stuff that can be a conversation starter. So I do tell the so many medical secretaries some of these stories, and some of them start talking about, oh my God, look at that company spilling information, Amazon, I don't trust it. And they start thinking a little bit about what they're doing, because actually they're interested then. And it seems a bit silly, because I'm just throwing a tip out of a failure and it looks like we're laughing at it, but actually they start realizing actually some of the stuff they do matters or lead to issues. So I don't know. I think it's like constant experimentation to see how it works, because every organization is different. People think differently and all that. Anyway, I'm sure you guys are all doing that. And
it's probably worth finding, you know, you talk about the fear mongering with the million or multi-million pound fines, so, you know, becoming desensitized to those. But if you could find relevant examples within your industry, within your organization's industry, that would probably really keep, you know, keep it down to earth with on an individual level, on a staff level, because they can see how it can go wrong in their role, and how, you know, it is preventable really, and how to prevent it.
Yeah,
it's something
absolutely.
We've been doing with the onboarding process. We've been providing some examples from the ICO website. Granted, they're 3 or 4 years old, where they've actually named some employees. I don't provide the name, but I showed the story and the source so they can see how much the fine was applied to individual people, just so it motivates everybody in the healthcare industry that I'm working in to be a little bit more cautious about it and don't assume the business is going to protect them fully from whatever implication or, you know, case they've been in. But do you have any tips? Give me as many as you can, and I'll let you carry on because I've taken on enough time. Thank you.
Yeah, if you've got any questions as well, feel free to ask and ask away, whether it's in the chat or unmuting. But thank you, Michael.
Okay. One thing I would like to say on this just before we wrap up, because we are over time, you know, scaremongering is a good way to, I guess, try and get people on board in terms of internally. But I think there's got to be a bit of a fine line there, simply because you don't want to scaremonger them too far where they're worried to do things with data. You know, I think there is that kind of, not, I don't know what you'd call it, but within organizations, I think you often find that they're, you know, they're a bit worried to send it, or can we send it here? You know, we don't have the consent to do this, but, you know, you might not need the consent. And then it, I just think that you've just got to be very careful, because then, you know, there could be a personal data breach and they go, oh God, there's been a breach. You know, we don't want the company to get fined. We'll just brush it under the cup like nothing's, brush it under the rug like nothing's happened, when in actual fact you need them to tell you straight away so that you can put things in place and report it to the ICO if necessary, because that is probably what you'd lead to more trouble, right? As opposed to you accidentally having a personal data breach, you'd come in more trouble if it was reportable and you didn't report it to the ICO than, you know, just letting the organization know of a breach. So you just got to be a bit careful with that. I think
some of this we can talk about next week, can't we, on the, if we're looking at this report on DPOs. Just as, I mean, we're well over time now, but just, I was in London yesterday at this Cloud and Cybersecurity Expo, and I want to talk about this next week as well. And I went down specifically because DLA Piper's Security Awareness Manager was doing a seminar on awareness, behavior, and security culture. And it was absolutely brilliant. There was some amazing stuff. Now, they use a platform called Know Before. They basically use that debate a bit and build on. But I mean, I'll talk about that next week. But one of the things, for instance, that they do is they instead of running phishing campaigns, they run a phishing tournament, and they challenge, they've got 2,000 lawyers in the business, they challenge the lawyers to try and, you know, we're going to send you phishing campaigns, and whoever rejects the most is going to win the phishing tournament. So that a lot of the stuff they're doing training wise they're turning on their head, and they're getting people engaged. And it was a brilliant, you know, 25 minute talk from this guy at DLA Piper.
That sounds quite interesting, that.
Yeah, it does. The messages are coming in, so I've just lost one I was going to speak about. Stella said in the chat that she doesn't like the scare tactic because it stops you from being approachable. And I think that relates back to your point, Joe, of there being a fine line and being really careful in how you approach that, because you don't want to come as the person who's like cracking the whip and, you know, trying to scare people directly, you know, yourself. You don't want to be that person. You do want to be approachable and be, you know, that safety net for people to come in and ask questions freely. But at the same time, I think by making it relatable and just really educating people on the real life risks that are involved, you know, it has a really good effect. I mean, it had a really good effect with me. That's probably why I advocate for it. Oh my God, it's a bit worrying that, you know, like the example of I've probably mentioned this so many times, I always forget who I've said what to, but there's an example of a data breach in a housing association where there was a mother and a child fleeing domestic violence, domestic abuse, and they were in a safe house, and the father came in, or the husband came in and asked, I don't know if it was the father or the child, but they came and asked for the address, and the person on the reception just disclosed it, not thinking anything of it, not doing the proper checks, and the father went and shot the mother and the child. And just by, you know, disclosing an address, you think that's so low level, you don't see the risk around it, but the effect that it can have is scary. So not to fearmonger everyone on this, let me just get that straight, but it is, you know, it's worrying, it's chilling, but there are positive sides to it as well that I can't think about now, so we'll end it there.
Now, I think that this session had a positive impact on Joe's demeanor. I think he's less hungover. I think we should carry on all afternoon till 5.
Certainly not. I am less hungover and I've chipped in a little bit more than I thought it would as well, actually. So I'm quite pleased with myself on that. But
well done.
I think we should call it here as we're 8 minutes over the allotted hour. So
go get some lunch. All right.
I'm
well,
hungry.
Thank you very Rachel, much. Thank you very much for joining. Everyone. It's been a really good session. We will be back for part two of the big and the small of it in a couple of weeks, and we'll be talking more about the DPDI bill on that one as well, and how that might have an effect on small and large organisations. Next week we will be back for a GDPR radio session, and yeah, we hope to see you there. Thank you for joining.
Cheers, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
See you later.